Let's start with Donald Trump's decision to have J.D. Vance as his vice president. And what's your understanding on Donald Trump's position right now when it comes to foreign policy and the conflicts that the United States is facing in Ukraine, China, and in the Middle East? But let's first of all focus on the conflict in Ukraine. What does it mean for the conflict in Ukraine?
I think what it shows is that President Trump has selected a vice presidential running mate who agrees with him across the board on issues, and particularly in foreign policy. President Trump has made it very clear that he opposes the war in Ukraine. He does not support continuing it. He does not support funding it. President Trump has said that if I'm elected, he said on day one, I will end the war. And now J.D. Vance, I think, was a bit of a surprise for some of the more hawkish members of the Republican Party, and certainly for the very intensely hawkish Democrat Party. The Democrats have basically taken the position that the fact that Russia is fighting to defend Russian-speaking people right on its border, I don't know what the distance is, but it's very, very close to the border of Russia where they're fighting. And the Democrats see this as an outrage. This is a terrible thing. They don't have a problem when the United States goes and attacks Libya, which is on the other side of the earth. And Libya has never done a single thing to the United States. And under President Obama, we went in, we literally destroyed one of the greater civilizations in Africa, and we have never allowed an election to be held since then. So for the Democrats, they're all in for war, but J.D. Vance has been sort of taken them back, because now not only are they worried about President Trump, but they're thinking, okay, if something could be done to remove President Trump, if perhaps a bullet found its way in his direction and brought him down, then we're faced with J.D. Vance. Now, let me give you a little bit on J.D. Vance. He's immensely popular within the Republican Party. He has a good deal of appeal to moderates and to some Democrats who are on the more moderate side. Here's what he says about Ukraine. He's known as one of the leading opponents of the war against Russia. And he says, quote, I think it's ridiculous that we're focused on this border in Ukraine. I've got to be honest with you. I don't really care what happens to Ukraine one way or the other. End quote. He led the battle in the Senate that for months delayed this monstrous $60 billion military aid package for Ukraine. And when the final vote, you know, eventually it did pass, but afterwards he made a statement to the press, and he said, quote, I voted against this package in the Senate and remain opposed to virtually any proposal for the United States to continue funding this war, end quote. So you can see he has absolutely no interest in lifting a finger to perpetuate this war. Not only that, he goes beyond, he goes beyond what Donald Trump has said. And he has been a very harsh critic of Poland's very pro-war Prime Minister, Donald Tusk. And he said, quote, the new leader of Poland is arresting political opponents. He owes his country's security to the generosity of mine, talking about the United States. And then he says, quote, he might consider showing some appreciation or at least toning down his own authoritarian impulses. So he gives a very harsh criticism of the war makers within NATO. He says that Berlin's military is a basket case and its energy policy is idiotic. So very, very critical Chancellor Scholz. Then he says, referring to the AfD party, which is the explosively expanding conservative party in Germany, he says, quote, AfD is doing well because of a rising resistance to mass migration. And he's very much against this idea that the globalists have of displacing the native populations with people imported basically to break up the unity of various countries. And he talks about the Italian leader Meloni. And he says, Meloni's victory in Italy was very much a rejection of the immigration policies in Brussels. And yet she's been a complete catastrophe when it comes to actually reducing migration to Italy. So that just gives you sort of an idea. J.D. Vance seems very, very skeptical of the NATO leadership, the leaders of the European Union, which is anything, by the way, but democratic. The European Union is essentially, you have an executive branch, and instead of electing the executive, it's just appointed bureaucrats, and they make all the laws, and then the people that the people elect, the members of the European Parliament, all they can do is they can tinker with what the dictators tell them. They can't vote the dictators out of office. That's the European Commission that sits at the top. The European Parliament is below. The European Parliament, the members can't even introduce a bill to make a proposal. I mean, it's the European Union is a very cunning, crafty dictatorship that's designed to just keep a military boot on the heel of the people of Europe.
Is Donald Trump capable of keeping these people who have captured his administration in his first term, these neocons, out of his office if he wins 2024?
This is a very good question. When President Trump was in office before, there was a very large and deep conspiracy to block everything that he did. And they started by going after General Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, and by pulling Michael Flynn out early on, they managed to disrupt his operation. They then put the people that they wanted in place, and they undermined him from the very beginning. Now, part of the reason is that although the Republicans held the House and the Senate, the Republicans who led those parts of Congress were globalists. Their mentality was that the highest level of politics did not stop at the president. He was not like the top of the pyramid. The top of the pyramid was the globalists, the people, the kind of people who attend the World Economic Forum in Davos, the world's billionaires and Hollywood stars and you know religious figures who go out and they you know they hang out on the bars in their super yachts and this kind of thing, and they you know and they're told, okay, here's the agenda of the globalists, and this is what we will implement. And, you know, it's not just the World Economic Forum. That's just an example. But you have the Bilderberg Group. You have a number of these very shadowy groups that the people who are involved in them tend not to think of themselves as being citizens of Brazil or of the United States or of Germany or Russia, but instead thinking of themselves as a superior race of people who are above all of mankind. And their ultimate goal is to take away any role that citizens have in determining the outcome of the policies of their nation and their communities, and basically just crushing them out. And they're fine using elections for the time being, but ultimately they see elections as being just nothing but a tool to sort of legitimize the dictates of the elite. So you had this cabal of venomous, sinister people who attacked Donald Trump, and he was constantly on the defense. Now, that was then. Today, there's been a very dramatic change in the makeup of the Congress. The people who were anti-Trump, no-Trumpers, those people have just disappeared. The voters put them out of office, and now you have a Congress that is much more friendly towards Trump and towards his policies. And the chances are, of course, there are going to be congressional elections held in conjunction with the presidential election on November the 5th. So what you're going to have, I suspect, is you're going to have a good majority in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate. And I'm guessing that with the demise of President Biden, some congressmen have even questioned whether he's still living, and they're demanding proof of life to prove that he's still alive even. So the Democrats are in disarray, and Kamala Harris seems to be the clear candidate of the Democrats. She's not officially there, but the party has sort of come to grips with the fact that she's the only one we can get in there. And nobody likes Kamala Harris. Not the Democrats don't like her. The Republicans don't like her. But so you have a tremendous difference in the political environment. You're going to have a very, very pro-Trump Congress. And you are also going to find a federal court system which is far more friendly towards Donald Trump than the one that he encountered. He was able to make significant changes, make a great number of appointments to the federal judiciary. The justices of the U.S. Supreme Court are dramatically different. They may not be as socially conservative as some people had hoped, even though they're much more conservative, but where they are extremely conservative is in returning to the way that the U.S. Constitution had designed our form of government, where you would have a separation of powers between the executive branch led by the president, the Congress that makes the laws and appropriates the money, and the federal courts. And there had been a blending of these, and tremendous power had shifted to the federal bureaucracy, which was issuing regulations that had the force of law, and really Congress had not had not rendered an opinion on whether it wanted those laws or not. Even the president had. It was just like they were a law unto themselves. And there's been a really monumental decision rendered by the U.S. Supreme Court that deals with a principle. It strikes down a principle called the Chevron deference rule. And what Chevron deference did back in the early 80s, the U.S. Supreme Court back then said that if a federal agency issues a regulation, then generally the court should defer to that agency, and unless there's something extremely out of line, that should be accepted as the law. That has been rejected. It's been repealed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and all of a sudden, this is beginning to constrict the federal bureaucracy and to remove this immense power that they had. So all of these things come together to make the environment much more conducive to Donald Trump. And there are quite a number of people now who think that that's one of the reasons for the assassination attempt on the president. There are increasing numbers of people who are beginning to conclude that this was not just some young kid who got up on the roof and shot at the president, but that he was part of a greater scheme to make sure that he was eliminated because of the threat that he poses to the entire structure that the deep state has created over the years. I don't know, but it's difficult to argue with the people who are pointing out all of the circumstances of the assassination attempt that suggests that it was something far more massive and far more sinister than just some young fellow who got up and took a pot shot at the president.
Yeah. The other question would be how J.D. Vance can help Donald Trump to overcome the difficulties that he has been facing during his first term, considering Ukraine. He was forced to send weapons to Ukraine, put many sanctions on Russia. And on the other hand, we know that it was his administration that withdrew from INF Treaty. How do you see, are we going to have some sort of adjustment, some sort of modifications in his policy toward Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I think what you have to do is look at the heart of his position. When President Trump, early in his time as president, he made it clear, really during the campaign, he made it clear that he didn't think much of NATO. That, you know, maybe the United States should just withdraw from NATO completely. And this caused a huge uproar because NATO is the means by which the deep state controls all of Europe. When World War II ended, NATO was established and an American four-star general was put in place. We had never allowed a European general to command NATO because NATO is an American organization. It's an alliance headed by the United States. And through NATO, we're able to dominate the European Union and we're able to dominate all of the policies of Europe. It's through this mechanism that we were able to say, okay, close down all of your coal mines. You know, we're gonna require you to go to using windmills and sun chips and corn liquor in your gas tank and this kind of thing, and just forget about the economics of energy. You don't need to worry about that because something will take care of it. And then, of course, it was the United States during this Ukraine war that took one of the most phenomenally provocative steps that has ever been taken in human history. We sabotaged the Nord Stream pipeline, along with a number of these NATO countries were involved. We know that the British were involved. We know that the Norwegians were involved. There were other Scandinavian countries. There may have been some involvement from the German government, even. The gas that flowed from Russia to Germany was very much like the artery that feeds your heart, and your heart beats because the blood flows into your heart. When you stop the blood from coming into your heart, the heart stops and you die. And we were willing to do this in order to advance the war, we thought, to advance the war in Ukraine. And as a result, there hasn't been a whole lot of injury done to Russia, but it's just had a devastating impact on the economy of Europe. It's thrown Germany into a recession. There are Americans, there are people around the world now who are helping to support poor German families. Now, Germany used to be the most prosperous place in Europe and one of the most prosperous in the world. The idea that now foreigners are having to send money to Germany to help German people who are struggling to feed themselves is just, it's just unbelievable. So the direction of things when Trump was in, yes, there were things he was forced into doing. Instead of saying we're going to get out of NATO, he said, well, what I really mean is they need to pay their fair share. That was a good fallback position. You can, you know, even a president, is he's a politician, there is only so much maneuvering room he has. And under immense pressure, he just exhibited flexibility. But it's clear that he is skeptical of NATO and its present posture. There are some people who have proposed that if NATO is to continue, that there needs to be a NATO, there needs to be a European four-star general in charge. Why should an American come from the other side of the planet and run the military forces in Europe? That makes no sense. It's absurd. So I think whatever happens, you're likely to see some modification of the US position towards NATO. I don't know what it will be at this point, but you need, when you look at what President Trump did in his first term in office, you need to understand the immense pressures on him and how that diminished his maneuvering room, forced him to accept certain pressures that were brought to bear on him. He's not going to have those same pressures, not to that extent. Every president, I don't care who it is, whether it was Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt, despite their monumental power, they all have some pressures. That'll be no different with Trump. He will have pressures on him. He will have to bend and flex, but he will be in a vastly more powerful position where he will end the war in Ukraine. I don't have the slightest doubt that that will happen.
Do you understand the behavior of Europeans right now? They're trying to isolate Orban because he's trying to do some sort of deal between Russia and the United States and between Russia and NATO. And on the other hand, it seems that behind the scene, they're trying to convince Zelensky to continue this conflict because Zelensky, he cannot continue this war. They don't have any manpower. They don't have weapons to do this. And right now, when you see the attitude of European Union and just asking, why are they doing this? What's the benefit for Europe? Because if in case of having any sort of political settlement, Europe would benefit immediately from that because they have to, right now they have to send weapons, money, everything to Ukraine. At least they don't have to send them to Ukraine, and they may have some sort of, I don't know, political settlement that would provide Europe, as you mentioned, the Nord Stream pipeline. Maybe again, this can connect between Russia and Germany, and the huge changes would come to Europe. Do you understand why they're doing this? Are they doing this because of the Democratic Party? They want to help the Democratic Party to win the election in the United States?
I think it's important to recognize that for the most part, the leaders in Europe don't feel that their first allegiance is to the people of their countries. In other words, Chancellor Scholz doesn't look out and say, okay, what concerns the German people? What would benefit the German people? The same thing with the French leader, the various leaders. They don't see themselves as being primarily responsible to their people. Instead, they see themselves as being part of this global movement. They're more concerned about what the boys from Davos say, at the World Economic Forum. They're more concerned about what the Bilderberger types, there are London bankers, enormous London bankers, there are enormous Wall Street bankers, there are the largest hedge funds in the world, outfits like BlackRock, there are these political elites that man this vast foreign policy war movement, the arms industries. All of these people have placed enormous bets on the war. Now, Russia entered the war and it started their special military operation. And when they did, 4 days after Russian troops crossed the border into Ukraine, 4 days afterwards, they began peace talks with the government in Ukraine. Both parties came together. I think they realized that both sides had their legitimate concerns. Within just 2 months after the special military operation started, they had put pen to paper. They hadn't finalized everything, but they were ready for peace. And the top negotiator for the Ukrainians went back to Kiev and he says, this is going to be wonderful. We have almost resolved everything. We've got some sticking issues over Crimea and different things. But he said, we're, essentially he was saying, we're going to have a peace deal. At that point, the White House coordinated with London, and they sent Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He flew into Kiev unannounced, and he got with Zelensky and basically put the law down to him that you're going to get back to fighting and knock off this business about peace talks. And it was understood there's big money. They have placed their bets on this war, and they expect a return on their investment. And now at that point, 2 months into the war, there'd been a lot of sound and fury, but Russia was very cautious to avoid causing casualties and to avoid property damage. I remember one scene where there was a Russian tank that was roaring down the road, and a group of Ukrainian civilians came out in the road and just protested. The tank stopped. It was not about to run over people as you would in a normal wartime situation. And basically just a group of old men and women and children just stopped the tanks from rolling. That's because they were under orders from President Putin down through the chain of command. We don't want to kill people. We don't want civilians to die. We're not real anxious to have Ukrainian soldiers die, for that matter. We just want to, you know, make a point politically, and then we want to have some negotiations and get this thing done. So there's very little property damage. The casualties were very low. There, you know, at the 2 month point, I don't know, there might have been a couple thousand people who had been killed. It may not have been that high, but it was nothing. I mean, it was trivial compared to what it is today. And it was the United States and the NATO countries representing the London and Wall Street banks, the hedge funds, the big money people. And they said, no, we're going to have this war. We're going to have this bloodshed. And at this point, it's really anybody's guess how many people have died. Ukraine, every day they put out, oh, look at this, 1,000 Russians have been, you know, casualties last night. It's all every day. There's all 1,000. This is baloney. It's rubbish. We don't know. No, there are a lot of casualties. The Russians are taking a lot of casualties because they're on the offense. When Ukraine launched its big counterattack, the one that was supposed to roll through and just drive the Russians to the sea within a week, it was just one of the most disastrous battles in modern history. It was a terrible thing to see, because the U.S. had planned the whole operation and had said, oh, look, we'll show you, this is going to be really neat. We'll have you maneuver and all, just like the German army did in the Second World War. And it didn't work, because war has changed. And it was just an enormous, horrible bloodbath for the Ukrainians. Just, you know, hundreds of thousands of young and older Ukrainian men just being sent to the slaughter. Very, very few Russian soldiers died in that counteroffensive. It was mostly Ukrainians. So it goes back and forth. Usually whoever's attacking suffers heavy casualties, and the defenders suffer fewer casualties, at least until the defense breaks down, and then it can shift. But anyway, the tremendous destruction, the tremendous bloodshed, it came about because of a very cold, calculating decision by NATO that we got a lot of money on the line. We've got our power and prestige on the line. We really don't care if every man, woman, and child in Ukraine dies. I mean, that literally is the reality when you look at NATO and the very corrupt people who have run this thing from the top.
When it comes to the conflict with China, do you think that let's put it this way, is the Republican Party, that part of Republican Party that is connected with the Democratic Party, is connected with the blob, are they going to be able to convince Donald Trump to go after China militarily in Taiwan?
First of all, it's important to understand that China has not the slightest intention of attacking Taiwan. Taiwan is a great distance from China. Now, it looks, if you look at a global map, it looks like it's close, but the English Channel at its narrowest point is 21 miles. The straits between the mainland and Taiwan is about 150 miles. So it's far greater than the English Channel. The English Channel prevented England from being invaded for centuries and centuries. Adolf Hitler could never cross the English Channel. So for the People's Republic of China to conduct a military invasion of Taiwan presents monumental difficulties. First, crossing that body of water is very difficult. Also, the terrain of Taiwan is very, very difficult. It is very rugged terrain. It's not the kind where, it's not like one of these beach islands of the Pacific that the Marines would land on and attack the Japanese who had occupied the island. Taiwan is very, very rugged and very defensible. So if you look at China historically, China views itself as having a history that goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years, a civilization that goes back that period. And when they talk about reuniting Taiwan with the mainland, they're not holding their breath saying, we got to do this, we got to do this right now. They're very patient and they're willing to wait for the rollout of various political circumstances. And I think the only time that you see a really aggressive stance from the People's Republic of China is when they're provoked. And so when Nancy Pelosi flew with a delegation to talk about Taiwan breaking away completely from China, then, you know, China's forced politically, they're just forced to respond in kind. Honestly, my guess is that if we would stop, they don't care if we run an American ship through the Straits of Taiwan. What they care about is when we make a big provocative display, when we send American and ships from other countries and we run through the straits, because under Chinese law, the island of Taiwan is part of China. And so we put the pressure on them. We're the ones who are constantly putting the fire under the kettle and making it boil. If we would stop doing it, the kettle would stop boiling, and I think the Chinese would go back to their stance of being patient, perhaps waiting for an election to go in their favor that hasn't recently. So there is not a push for war out of China, and they're certainly not talking about sending landing craft and landing, or sending the Chinese fleet to the Gulf of Mexico to attack the United States. Nobody's attacking the United States. So I think what you'll see from Trump is really troubled by the fact that the United States, under the domination of some of these globalist types, they've just wiped out American factories. It was a horrible thing that they did. It was treasonous. The NAFTA was the big one. That was the North American Treaty Organization or North American Treaty on Trade. And anyway, basically, it was designed to take American manufacturing and ship it to Mexico. And it did this very effectively. It wiped out the communities all over America, sent all of the wealth down south of the border. And then we did agreements with the Chinese. And the Chinese had an enormous pool of extremely low-cost labor, and they were able to outcompete us on everything. We, by giving them most favored nation status, we shipped another huge wave of factories. And if you look at the United States now, you can look at cities that were once great powerhouses. You look at Detroit, Michigan. It used to be called the Motor City because that's where most of the world's automobiles were produced. Now you go through it, and it's a hideous place. It's just populated by drug addicts and criminals, violent crime. I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, and I only lived there till I was 4 years old. But people went to Baltimore because it was a great industrial city. During the Depression, my father worked at the Baldwin Locomotive Works. He wasn't a very mechanically oriented guy. He was a very intellectual guy, but he worked on a great industrial plane, and parts for locomotives would come out of the smelter, and a crane would pick them up, and they'd be dripping with hot drops of molten iron, and they'd come over and they'd go in here, and then he would operate the plane to take off the flashing that comes between the molds when you make castings of steel, and he would do that, so you had people coming for work. They wanted work, and they could get it in these great cities. Now, when I was I was born in Baltimore, like I said. Today, the population of Baltimore is less than it was in 1920. Before it ever became a great industrial city, now the population is back there. Why? Because the work is gone. The factories, the industry are gone. And so what you'll see from Donald Trump is the use of tariffs to try to restore the jobs to American factories. I hope that the tariffs work. I support tariffs generally, but I prefer for them to be across the board rather than targeted at a particular nation, because I think what we've seen is that when we place big tariffs on China, they simply move their final production to Vietnam or to other countries, and the American workers don't see the fruits of that. So I would encourage that we do across the board tariffs to level the playing field for American workers. We'll see what happens there.
And right now, Netanyahu is in the United States. How do you see the policy of Donald Trump when it comes to conflict in Gaza and how he can bring some sort of sanity to this conflict?
I think that Donald Trump, he's a much different politician than someone like Joe Biden or Barack Obama or Clinton. He is a great listener. People don't understand this. I once had been speaking for him. I was one of the warm-up speakers at an event. I did this all over Virginia. And as he was leaving, he had heard me speak, and he asked, he said, tell me, how are we doing in Virginia? And how's the campaign doing? And so I was explaining it to him. And you know, he kept asking questions, and the discussion went on. And his entourage, the campaign people, the Secret Service, they were saying, Mr. President, we've got to go now. And they were just telling him, you got to get moving because we're running late. And he said, no, he says, I got to listen to this guy. I want to hear what he's got to say. He was a good listener, not because, you know, I was, you know, this or that, but because he was interested. He said, okay, I can understand. This guy seems to know what he's talking about. So he's a good listener. And one of the first things he will do, instead of convening all of the experts to say, well, this and that, this situation, he's going to pick up the phone. He will probably be on the phone with Vladimir Putin the day after he's elected, or maybe the night that he's elected. He takes office at noon, and it's very likely he's going to have a talk with President Putin. He won't just talk, he will listen. This will be one of those rare times when President Putin can say, I'm so glad that you and I got to talk. We always got along fine before. You need to understand, I was forced into going across the border because this huge army had been built up and it was about to attack the Donbass republics. And those are all Russian people. And I couldn't just sit there and have them slaughtered by this huge army that Barack Obama built up. And Trump will listen. It doesn't mean he agrees with everything, but he'll listen. And when President Putin says, look, here's the problem, he says, you know, if you put NATO into Ukraine, that means that you can put nuclear tipped missiles that can reach Moscow within a couple of minutes, and then you and I won't be able to discuss that something unusual is happening, what's wrong, where the other one could say, you know, I just got word that there was some sort of an accident and this happened. Instead, President Putin will probably say, look, here's the problem. Because the time will be so short, everything is going to have to be done on artificial intelligence. We're going to have computers decide whether the nuclear holocaust will begin or not. We won't be able to control it. You and I won't be able to control it. President Trump he'll get it. He'll understand it. And we've got to get NATO out of Ukraine. During the Cold War, I was stationed with U.S. forces, and I was prepared to die in the defense of Germany if the Soviet Union had attacked. We had two gargantuan armies that were just nose to nose, nuclear weapons on both sides and so forth. And one time I took a trip over into Austria. Now, Austria was not part of the NATO alliance, but I was able to go in. And unlike all of the other countries that were right on the border, that were just tense and so sensitive that with every little thing that happened, I went into Austria and the people were happy. They were prosperous. They were celebrating Christmas. It was the most joyous, beautiful thing. I can't tell you this. We were in Vienna, and oh my gosh, it was wonderful. And I didn't even quite understand at that point what had happened, but there was an odd coming together of the Soviet Union and NATO, US in particular. And they came up with an agreement. They said, look, both sides will pull their troops out of Austria, and we will make it a demilitarized location. It won't be part of NATO. It won't be part of the Warsaw Pact. And Austria will change its constitution to say that no foreign troops may be permitted on the territory of Austria, and Austria will not join any alliance. They will not allow foreign troops. And as a result, the people in Austria, they were like in heaven. Everybody else on the front was in hell. They lived in constant terror. And the people in Austria, they were joyous, they were prosperous. The economy was booming because they didn't have to worry about war. They didn't have to worry about having some big armed force. That's my dream for Ukraine, is to replicate what happened in Austria during the Cold War. And that should be the buffer between East and West, tremendous protection against nuclear war. You in Brazil, I in the United States, people in Russia, people in Japan, everybody will be so much safer against the threat of nuclear war than if we succeeded in driving Russia out of Ukraine, making Ukraine part of NATO, and moving our nuclear weapons right up to the edge where the East and West will have to live in this constant sense of tension and danger. We have the perfect blueprint. It happened during the Cold War, and it was wonderful, and it can be wonderful for the people of Ukraine. I'm going to tell you, if this came about, now Ukraine is now a nation of widows and orphans. It's just terrible. But the cloud that will be lifted from them would just be unbelievable. And there'll be a chance that Ukraine can return to a place of happiness and prosperity again.
And just about Gaza, do you think that he's gonna be able to do anything in Gaza in terms of bringing some sort of political settlement?
This is a much more difficult question. I'm not a personal fan of Mr. Netanyahu. He obviously did a disastrously poor job of protecting the settlements near the Gaza border. He had pulled a lot of troops out of there. He had automated the defenses, which made them very vulnerable to penetration. So, you know, were it not for the war that's going on, I don't think he would last a minute in Israel. There's tremendous opposition to him within Israel from very high-ranking people, former heads of Israel, former heads of the Mossad, former heads of the defense establishment. And the war in Gaza has proven to be far more difficult than anything that the Israelis anticipated. They have used maximum force, and just done enormous destruction. And I don't think anybody would have ever questioned their right to a reprisal, to, you know, you punch me, I get to punch you back. But the slaughter has become so massive. And I think that public support for the Israeli position has definitely diminished a great deal. Netanyahu is an extremely divisive, unpopular figure, you know, on both sides of the aisle. He does have support with somebody who sees him as sort of symbolic of Israel. And there's a tremendous amount of support for Israel in the United States. But I think opposition to the war in Gaza is very intense. I know that President Trump would like nothing better than to end the war. I think to some extent, you know, the war in Gaza has just torn the Democratic Party apart. You have Muslim Americans who are very important in the key state of Michigan. And the Democrats have lost enormous support from the Muslim American community there. The Jewish community has been torn apart. I was surprised that in the early demonstrations against the war in Gaza, many of them were organized by Jewish Americans. And when that was reported to me first, I got an intelligence report. I said, are you sure? I understand that there are some Jewish people there, maybe with flags, but no, it's being organized by Jewish Americans. So you have that group of Jewish Americans, and then you have another group, and some of the very, very wealthiest tend to be on the other side, where they are just a little bit more doctrinaire about, you know, that Israel needs to forge on. I think that President Trump will probably do everything he reasonably can to end that war. I'm not privy to the mechanisms he will use. I'm not sure that he even knows for certain. The situation's going to be different by next January. Who knows what will have unfolded. But the one thing that I will give Biden some credit for, now, you know, he has continued to provide these 2,000-pound bombs, which are designed to just obliterate major buildings of all sorts. And so sort of the infrastructure that supports civilization in Gaza is just being systematically destroyed by enormous numbers of American provided, Biden provided 2,000 pound bombs. And but the one thing I will say that Biden has done is, I think, because the world is aflame, you know, he has personally promoted a huge war in Ukraine. It wasn't, Putin didn't want to start a war in Ukraine. It was the United States and NATO that wanted to start the war in Ukraine. And we knew if we pushed far enough, we'd force the Russians' hand. And so we, you know, that was a decision made by Biden. So he's got this immense war going here. He suddenly has this war breakout in Gaza, which that was not something that he promoted. But once it started, he was all in for, you know, whatever level of destruction and killing of the Palestinians was, he was fine with that. But at least he realized, you know, at the same time, he's trying to start some hostilities with China. And there are just too many moving parts, all of this war. And, you know, we're still occupying Syria, have American troops without, you know, we've gone across Syria's borders and occupied, and yet we seem outraged that Russia has come out. Well, there aren't any Americans in Syria. There are Russians in Ukraine. And yet we go in and we occupy and we just seize the country. Well, so there's all of this mess in foreign policy, but at least to his credit, he recognized that if we were to begin a big war with Iran, and Iran doesn't want war with the United States. They don't want war with Israel or anybody else. They just want to be left alone, but they're willing to fight back. And so at least Biden did not expand the war. He took some pretty ingenious measures to avoid Netanyahu. Netanyahu had tried to provoke war with Iran by bombing the consulate, the Iranian consulate in Damascus. He wanted to do the most outrageous thing he could, which was to violate international law, well-known international law, by attacking a foreign consulate, diplomatic immunity land. And in the United States, through some very, very interesting maneuvers, coordinated with Iran so that Iran could satisfy its own people that it was taking aggressive action in response. And then we shot down a lot of the missiles and coordinated all of that. And it was just, we worked together hand in glove with Iran to prevent this thing from blowing up. And I think that was a very, very skillfully done thing, which satisfied all of the political realities of the moment. So thus far, Netanyahu has not been able to expand the war. He wants very much to have a war with Hezbollah. He wants to attack Lebanon, and Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. Under their governmental structure, they have a Christian president, and they have a Sunni who holds one position and a Shia who holds the other. The name of the Shia party is Hezbollah, and then they have a military force on the border to protect against Israeli incursions, which have been frequent over decades. Hezbollah is very highly disciplined, highly trained, battle-hardened, experienced army. The only way that Israel can hope to defeat Hezbollah within Lebanon is if they can draw the United States into the war. And I think Netanyahu has wanted to do this very badly. And so far, the Biden administration has not taken the bait. And so at least within the Gaza arena, they have kept the virus from spreading. And perhaps next you involve the Egyptian army and the Turkish army, and then you have World War III. So they have done a pretty commendable job there. I have to think that as it gets closer to January 20th, when President Trump would take office if he's elected, that the Israeli people are going to say, it's really time to wrap this thing up. Just the other day, China pulled off a huge diplomatic coup, and they have united the factions of the Palestinian people. So the Palestinians in Gaza, the Palestinians on the West Bank, all Palestinians now are politically united in favor of a two-state solution, which is what Netanyahu has been trying desperately to avoid. He does not want the Palestinians to have anywhere to live. And that has always been a problem since the very beginning of Israel was, okay, where do the Palestinians go? These are the indigenous people who have lived there since time immemorial. And they live together with Jews, together with Christians. And where do they go? They can't just disappear from the face of the earth. And so there has been this continuing effort for a two-state solution. Netanyahu's approach, his very militant approach to dealing with foreign policy, has been to try to separate the parts. In fact, there's plenty of evidence that he promoted Hamas in the Gaza Strip. He's the reason that there wasn't unity and that a more radical group was able to be elected. He helped them to get elected. And now China has brought everybody back together under a representative, but more moderate group of leaders. And I think that's going to increase the pressure for a two-state solution. So we'll see. I'm hoping that by January, the environment will be better for Trump and he'll be able perhaps to push things over and to finally bring about a peace agreement for the parties.